What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guests this morning are Noah Levitt and Helen Kim, who have studied Jewish-American intermarriage and write a fascinating study about it. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom and Lashana Tova. It's Rosh Hashanah tonight, the beginning of a new 5773 year in Jewish tradition, a time for new beginnings and a fresh start. So I'll begin by wishing you the traditional Rosh Hashanah greeting, Lashana Tova Tikatevu Vetechatemu. May you be written and sealed in the Book of Life for a good year. If last year was a good year for you, this is the time to celebrate it and give thanks for it, as well as to pray for a repeat performance. If last year was not such a good year for you, this is a good time to get it out of your system, to apologize to those you've wronged and atone for what you didn't do that you should have done, and to ask forgiveness for what you did that you're sorry about having done. There is a central Jewish mitzvah, a commanded process, called tshuva, that is emblematic of this season of the days of awe. Tshuva means repentance or return, and it is the means through which we seek forgiveness for all we have done wrong in the previous year and try to return to those we love and to the best that is within us. That process is both unusual and interesting. When we think we might have offended someone, we go to them directly and ask their forgiveness for whatever we've done wrong. They are not obligated to forgive us, by the way, but we are obligated to seek their pardon. If they turn us down once, we're required to go back and ask a second time. If they turn us down again, we are then required to try to make it good a third time. And if, after three tries, they can't forgive us, then we are no longer obligated to keep trying. While some people see in this the source for baseball's three strikes and you're out policy, the truth is that Jewish tradition shows some pretty deep understanding of human psychology here. It takes courage to apologize to someone we know we have wronged. If they can forgive us easily enough, well and good. If they cannot do so quickly or easily, we are forced to summon more courage and apologize again. And they are compelled to look inside and see if they can overcome their injury and anger. Finally, if they refuse again, we must look deeper inside and seek to find the power to ask a third time. You know, it takes true character to apologize three times for offending someone. And it takes quite an injury to refuse to forgive someone who apologizes three times for hurting us. If the end result is not full closure, at least we surely know that we sought forgiveness with all of our abilities. In general, this tshuva process, if we enter into it honestly and sincerely, will bring us what we truly seek. A new year, clean, with clear consciences and repaired relationships. So may it be. To play us in this final morning of the 5772 year, from our High Holy Days musical preview, Hayom Harat Olam, from the Rosh Hashanah Morning Shofar Service, today is the birthday of the world.
Oh, Lord.
For Rosh Hashanah, tonight and tomorrow, the prayer Hayom Harat Olam, today is the birthday of the world, and we ask you, God, to have compassion on us as a father has compassion on his children. Our guests on Too Jewish this morning are a Jewish-Asian couple who decided to research why Jews marry Asians and why Asians marry Jews and what the results are for the family and for the children. Noah Levitt and Helen Kim have broken new ground with their scientific study of Jewish-Asian intermarriage. Find out why it happens and what it all means when we come back on Too Jewish.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, it's common knowledge that what's large to one person may appear small to another. Take pizza, for example. Some places sell a, quote, large pizza for a pretty large price. Then surprise, you get it home, it barely feeds three people. Some places sell you two large pizzas for the price of one. Believe me, they can't be too large unless they're using real cheap ingredients. But that's a subject for another commercial. Anyway, at Mama's, we think our family-sized pizza should be the yardstick for measuring all pizzas. In fact, you need a yardstick to measure it. The bottom line is that pizza size is all relative. And on behalf of all my relatives, we invite you to Mama's to try one of our pizzas, no matter what size. After all, every Mama's Pizza has a taste that's huge. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. You can check them all out at mamasfamous.com. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
We're delighted to welcome to Too Jewish this morning our guests, Helen Kim and Noah Levitt, who have written a fascinating article, The Newest Jews, Understanding Jewish American and Asian American Marriages, which has made kind of a big media splash, probably helped by the marriage of Mark Zuckerberg to Priscilla Chan. Tell us what led you to do this work and a little bit of your own story.
Well, what led us to do this work was actually our own story. We met in Chicago in 1997, and as an Asian American female and a Jewish American male who came together, not necessarily because of our particular backgrounds, we started noticing that a lot of our friends and people that we knew, friends of friends, fit this demographic. And so we were interested in kind of looking at and investigating and understanding whether or not aspects of either being Asian American or being Jewish American, sort of racial, ethnic, and religious identity were factoring into why it is that these kinds of couples were emerging on the scene and were staying together and getting married and having kids. So the impetus was actually our own story.
It's funny how often it happens like that. Tell us what the most surprising finding you had in your study, which included interviews with, I think, 31 intermarried couples.
We had the chance to speak with 37 couples in four major metropolitan areas around the country. And one of the most surprising things, and certainly not expecting this at all, is that the vast majority of these Asian American Jewish households are raising, are creating Jewish homes and are raising children where there are children with strong senses of their Jewishness and sometimes strong senses of their other components of their background, but creating Jewish households from this combination of Judaism and Asian traditions coming together.
Were most of them raising their kids as we would define Jewish?
They were attending synagogue. They were going to Hebrew school or day school or Sunday school. They were practicing rituals in the home, regular Shabbat, all of the Jewish holidays across the full spectrum. They were participating in events with Jewish families, joining Jewish community centers. Affiliating with denominations in some cases, joining Chavurot. So a whole range of ways that we would point to things that we would say as indicators of Jewish homes and Jewish identity and Jewish practice.
Really interesting. This is just a taste. We'll continue with Noah Levitt and Helen Kim on Too Jewish and explore Jewish-Asian relations when we come back.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at toojewishradio@yahoo.com, T-O-O, Jewish Radio, or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website or download them from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. And here is our weekly 2012 presidential election campaign Jewish moment. Although it is over 6,000 miles from Jerusalem to Washington, D.C., the Israeli-American relationship keeps poking its head into the 2012 presidential election campaign. The rift between U.S. and Israeli leaders appeared to deepen last week. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu of Israel leveled the sharpest attack in years by an Israeli leader against Washington over differences on how to address Iran's nuclear program. Tensions escalated to the point that President Barack Obama spent an hour on the phone with the Israeli leader in a hastily arranged call hours after both governments said the White House wouldn't agree to an Israeli request for a meeting between the two leaders at the UN General Assembly in New York this month. The Israelis said their request was refused, but the White House said it was simply a scheduling conflict. Obama would be elsewhere and they could meet at another time. Prime Minister Netanyahu reaffirmed that they are united in their determination to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon and agreed to continue their close consultations going forward, the White House said. Well, this current dispute has been precipitated by Netanyahu insisting the U.S. needs to draw, quote-unquote, red lines that if crossed would trigger a U.S. military attack on Iran. Obama has declined to do so, citing the need for increased sanctions on Iran and other considerations. Some Israeli leaders have even derided Netanyahu's push for red lines. Dan Chalutz, the former head of the IDF, said, "When you have to shoot, shoot. Don't talk. Don't put red lines." But not meeting with Netanyahu is a political error for Obama, to most people. even though I think it would be wrong of the president to set red lines, as the prime minister is insisting. Nevertheless, it's very important to calm the Israelis down, said Martin Indyk, vice president, director of foreign policy studies at the Liberal Brookings Institution think tank in Washington, U.S. ambassador to Israel under Bill Clinton, and a former guest of Too Jewish. The most important person in this regard is Obama himself, because he is president and therefore is the best one to make it clear he's absolutely true to his word. He has Israel's back, and he will not allow Iran to acquire nuclear weapons, Indyk said. It's in the interest of everybody involved to provide Netanyahu with a ladder to climb down at this point, and not meeting with the prime minister is a mistake, even though it's understandable, continued Indyk. Mitt Romney has repeatedly accused Obama of shortchanging the relationship between the U.S. and Israel. And in response, Republican Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham urged Obama to find time to meet Netanyahu. I know we're in the middle of a contested election, but the consequences of Iran acquiring nuclear capability are earth-shattering, Graham said. Jewish and Israeli sensitivities are important to Obama. The Democratic Party was forced to alter its policy platform last week after it initially omitted a line from its 2008 platform calling Jerusalem capital of the Jewish state. Well, there are risks domestically for Netanyahu in all this, too. After a brief run in Netanyahu's government, and once again the leader of the Knesset opposition, Shaul Mofaz last week accused Netanyahu of sticking his hand too deep in the U.S. ballot box and expressed concern that the prime minister of Israel was sacrificing relations with Israel's closest strategic allies in the U.S. and Europe on the altar of stopping the Iranian nuclear program. Florida, with its many Jewish voters, is a key swing state this November. It's even farther from Washington to Tehran than it is to Jerusalem, but it begins to look as though the U.S. presidential election might go through there. That was our campaign 2012 Jewish election moment. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert, head of the Weintraub Israel Center in Tucson. Boker Tov, Guy, l'shana tova.
Boker Tov, Rabbi, shana tova u'metuka.
Very interesting and exciting end to the year with the U.S. ambassador murdered in Libya in an assassination, an attack on the U.S. embassy in Cairo, riots in the West Bank by the Palestinians against the Palestinian Authority, lots of unrest. What do you make of all of it?
You know, I'm looking at the riots. Let's focus first on the riots against the American embassy and the horrible assassination of
Libya,
the U.S.
Right.
Ambassador, John Christopher Stevens. I'm thinking to myself, you know, in the past, do you remember, Rabbi, that the Jewish riots after Mel Brooks did his film with Jews in Space? Do you remember those?
I seem to not remember those.
No.
Yeah.
Do you remember the Christian riots after Monty Python did their movie that
The
mocked,
Life of Brian, right?
Exactly. That
yeah,
basically mocked Jesus.
I must have missed that. Yeah, I don't recall that.
So that raises a really big question. You know, what is it about it that a film that most of us probably didn't even hear of that, you know, kind of laughed on Muhammad, okay, presented him in a bad light, and suddenly that turns into huge riots, and a lot of people kind of accepted, oh yeah, the Muslim feelings were hurt. Excuse me? Christian feelings were hurt when Monty Python did it. They didn't go and shoot rockets on ambassadors. Jewish feelings are hurt often. Now, I'm not saying that all Muslims are bad. I'm not saying that most Muslims are bad. But it does seem that there are significant leaders and probably most of the high level leaders in the Muslim world today and in the Muslim faith are supporting extreme violence. And I think that as the Western world, we need to come and say that is unacceptable. That is not a question of your feeling or freedom of speech. You know, that's a red line that shouldn't be crossed. Yeah, you can argue. You can say we shouldn't hurt your feelings. It's not okay or not nice to mock other person's faith. I agree. But that cannot serve as an excuse for riots, for murder, for, you know,
assassination of ambassadors of sovereign countries.
Take anger management courses. I don't know. Do something. You know, the other point is, you know, here in the States, a lot of people are walking with guns all around it. But I didn't see anyone walking with a rocket. Okay. Also, it kind of suggests the complexities of the Middle East. Libya is a country where the U.S. actually helped to liberate. Just recently, for the American perspective, they said, okay, now the Libyan people will be our best friends, our best allies forever. That's not the case.
Obviously, forever didn't last very long.
Right, and that's not how it works in the Middle East. Also, some people will tell us, well, it's a very small group, it's not the majority. Well, it might be small, but if they had the intelligence to know where the ambassador is and to be able to assassinate him with a rocket while he's being secured by American forces, and I'm sure that the U.S. had significant security in Libya, you know, they're not that small. You can't do it on your own. You can't do it with five friends. You need an organization. You need infrastructure. You need people.
You need intelligence, too.
You need intelligence.
Obviously, about where the Americans are going to be. Well, Guy, I'm sorry it's not happier news, but in spite of this, L'shana tova metuka, a good and a sweet year to you and your family, and maybe we'll see some abatement in this anger in the year to come. God willing.
L'shana tova.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
Everything you always wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 13th anniversary year with a brand new family class and in a new location. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. It's your turn now. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not, and we feed you too. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Jason Holtz lead an open, interactive exploration of the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Classes are offered all over the Tucson area, and enrollment is easy. Call 520-327-4501 to sign up. Taste of Judaism is a tremendously successful education and outreach program and an exciting learning opportunity for anyone who is simply curious about Judaism or who wants to deepen their knowledge and gain an understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The classes include delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. The sessions are free and open to all, regardless of religious background. But you do need to pre-enroll by calling 520-327-4501. This year, Taste of Judaism is offering both daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and the very popular Taste of Judaism family class held at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class with rabbis, while kids have their own Taste of Judaism children's program with Jewish stories, crafts, and activities with excellent THA teachers. It's a great learning opportunity for the whole family. There is no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Bila Anderson at 520-327-4501 for more information and register today.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom. L'shana tova, tikatevu v'techatemu.
Good morning, Rabbi, and Happy New Year to you, too.
We started talking last week about Brit Covenant, the end of dealing with sort of that circumcision issue in Germany. Brit Milah, the covenant of circumcision, is the oldest covenant in Judaism, goes back to Abraham long before the Ten Commandments. But it is, in an odd way, not the hardest commandment to keep. Let's explore that a little bit.
Right. Well, as you know, I teach a course at the University of Arizona called The History of Antisemitism, and we go back to the concept of the Brit, the covenant, the contract between God and the Jewish people. And yes, it's true that the first sort of chapter or paragraph of this covenant was God asking Abraham to circumcise himself and his son and the sons of his servants and his male servants. And this was all in the days before there were really sharp knives. I mean, imagine doing that with like a flint arrowhead or something, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so it wasn't so easy. And
no anesthetic.
Later, when Jews and then the earliest Christians, who also thought of themselves as Jews, were seeking to make converts, the problem of circumcision was so great that the very first church council on record, which was held in Jerusalem in the year 50, ruled that one could become a Christian directly without going through this Jewish rite of circumcision, which was, you know, the first step towards eroding many of the commandments in the Old Testament, which are no longer considered binding by Christians. But the first one to go was that one because it made it hard to attract converts. Now,
at least male converts.
Right. Now, the question is, I mean, it's an interesting point that you made last week that even Jews, never mind non-Jews, often confuse brit, which is the Hebrew for bris, right, which they use to refer to circumcision, the ritual of circumcision, which is actually part of the greater brit, which is a contract or a covenant between us and God. And I would argue several things. First of all, the Ten Commandments, which are sort of universally known, but edited slightly differently in different translations of the Bible. And depending on which edition you're using, either the first or the first and second basically say, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You will have no other gods before me. And I would argue that that commandment, which is probably the basis for our adhering to the covenant, is really the toughest of the commandments to observe, because we're not tempted every day to dishonor our parents or commit murder or commit theft. Whereas, since we live in a world full of other people who worship other gods, and we ourselves tend in certain senses to worship other gods, that commandment is very challenging, and yet it's the basis for our relationship to God and for our difference from the majority cultures in which we live. So I'd like to look more closely at this with you and your listeners in the next week or so, as we're in this high holiday period of reflection and atonement and thinking about our own behavior and our own relationships with other people and also with God.
Absolutely, Tom. Happy and a healthy new year. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Two astronauts land on Mars. Their mission is to determine whether there is oxygen on the planet. Look, it's simple, one of the astronauts says. Give me a box of matches. Either it burns and there's oxygen or nothing happens. So he takes the box, is ready to strike it, when out of the blue, a Martian appears, waving all seven of his arms. No, no, don't! The two astronauts look at each other, worried. Could there be an unknown explosive gas on Mars? Still, in the name of science, the astronaut takes up the match and prepares to strike it. Suddenly, a crowd of hysterical Martians appear out of nowhere, all waving their arms, shouting, no, no, don't do that, stop, please. One of the astronauts says in his radio, this is serious, it must be serious, but we're here for science, to know if humans can breathe on Mars. He strikes the match. It flames up, burns down, nothing happens. Turns to the Martians and says, why didn't you want us to strike a match? And the leader of the Martians comes forward and says, it's Shabbos today. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and find those Jews located everywhere. And now a word of Torah. This week we'll hear both the Rosh Hashanah reading in Temple tomorrow, as well as our Shabbat Shuvah, Sabbath of Repentance, Torah portion of Vayelech this coming Saturday. The two portions are actually connected by an odd element: the closeness to death. The Rosh Hashanah Torah reading is the tale of the binding of Isaac, the Akedat Yitzchak, read in Reform congregations on the morning of the first day of Rosh Hashanah, and in conservative and Orthodox shuls on the morning of the second day of Rosh Hashanah, Tuesday. It deals with the great and painful story of God commanding Abraham to sacrifice his only son Isaac on the altar as a kind of human korban, an offering to God. While the sacrifice itself is averted at the last moment by the intervention of an angel, and a ram caught by its horns in a nearby bush is substituted for Isaac, hence the connection to Rosh Hashanah, where the shofar is sounded in the morning service, it is still a powerful and troubling tale. Our Shabbat Shuvah portion of Vayelech, near the end of the Torah in the very last stages of the book of Deuteronomy, tells of the final days of Moses, his last instructions to the people of Israel he has led for so many challenging years. In Rosh Hashanah's Torah reading of the Akedah, Abraham is told to sacrifice his son, but the killing is actually averted. But in the Shabbat Shuvah Torah portion of Vayelech, the killing, that is, the death of Moses, will surely come. The connection in this season of judgment is to Rosh Hashanah, a day in which we dress in the white clothing of the shroud and face our own personal judgment day. On Rosh Hashanah, Yom HaDin, the day of judgment, like Abraham and unlike Moses, we have the chance to avert an evil decree, the opportunity to turn a kind of spiritual death sentence into a renewed message of hope, renewal, and spiritual cleansing. May this week's Torah readings help us to find our own message of life and truth by compelling us to look at even the possibility of our own passing. For when we face death, we learn to value life and to live it as though it truly matters, which surely it does. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guests Noah Levitt and Helen Kim will explain why Jews marry Asians and just what happens to the kids. Stay with us on Two Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Everything you always wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 13th anniversary year with a brand new family class and in a new location. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. It's your turn now. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not, and we feed you too. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Jason Holtz lead an open, interactive exploration of the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Classes are offered all over the Tucson area, and enrollment is easy. Call 520-327-4501 to sign up. Taste of Judaism is a tremendously successful education and outreach program and an exciting learning opportunity for anyone who is simply curious about Judaism or who wants to deepen their knowledge and gain an understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The classes include delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. The sessions are free and open to all, regardless of religious background. But you do need to pre-enroll by calling 520-327-4501. This year, Taste of Judaism is offering both daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and the very popular Taste of Judaism family class, held at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class with rabbis, while kids have their own Taste of Judaism children's program with Jewish stories, crafts, and activities, with excellent THA teachers. It's a great learning opportunity for the whole family. There is no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila Anderson at 520-327-4501 for more information and register today.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
While not strictly Jewish news, the Arab world around Israel seems to be teetering back into major instability again. In North Africa, one U.S. embassy was attacked and another U.S. ambassador was killed, and in the West Bank, Palestinians are now rioting against their own Palestinian authority. In Egypt, fanatical Islamic protesters climbed the walls of the U.S. Embassy in Cairo and tore down the American flag, replacing it with a black flag with an Islamic inscription, supposedly to protest a movie attacking Islam's prophet Muhammad. Hundreds of protesters marched to the fortress-like U.S. Embassy in downtown Cairo, gathered outside its walls, and chanted slogans against the movie, whose origins are mysterious, but which was reportedly produced in the U.S. "Say it, don't fear, their ambassador must leave," the crowd chanted. Dozens of the protesters scaled the walls of the embassy building, went into its courtyard, pulled down the American flag, brought it back to the crowd outside, and tried to burn it, but failed somehow, so they tore it apart. The protesters then raised the Muslim flag. The declaration on it was, "There is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet," a standard Muslim exhortation. But the flag was similar to Al-Qaeda's banner. It's popular with Islamic fundamentalists all around the Dar Maghreb. Dozens of riot police in Egypt lined up along the embassy walls, but did not stop the protesters, who climbed up the wall and stood on it chanting. Nearly all the U.S. Embassy staff members had left the compound before the protest, probably tipped off, and the ambassador was out of town. The protest was a result of outrage over the movie that was promoted by an anti-Muslim Egyptian Christian campaigner in the U.S., clips of which you can see on YouTube. They're dubbed in Egyptian Arabic. The video depicts Muhammad as a fraud, actually shows him having sex and calling for massacres. Muslims find it offensive to depict Muhammad at all, let alone in this way. One member of the ultra-conservative Islamic fundamentalist Salafi movement, Abdul Hamid Ibrahim, said, "This is a very simple reaction to harming our prophet." In Washington, a State Department spokeswoman, Victoria Nuland, said the U.S. was working with Egyptian authorities to restore order. Good luck. More tragically, the U.S. ambassador to Libya and three embassy staff were killed outside a consulate building in Benghazi, which was stormed by Al-Qaeda-linked gunmen, blaming America for that same film. Gunmen attacked and set fire to the U.S. consulate in the eastern city of Benghazi, the cradle of last year's uprising against Muammar Gaddafi's 42-year rule. The California-born ambassador to Libya, Christopher Stevens, was trying to leave the consulate building for a safer location as part of an evacuation when the gunmen attacked. The American ambassador and three staff members were killed when rockets were fired in their direction, said a Libyan official. The attack was believed to have been carried out by Ansar al-Sharia, an al-Qaeda-style Sunni Islamist group that has been active there. The assassination raised questions about future U.S. diplomatic presence in Libya at all. Relations between Washington and Tripoli, the unstable security situation in post-Gaddafi Libya, and whether even more protests might take place in the Muslim world this coming week. President Barack Obama, whose administration supported the Libyan insurgency with funds, weapons, and training, branded the killings an outrageous attack and ordered increased security at U.S. diplomatic posts worldwide. And finally, in the West Bank, Palestinian demonstrators, fed up with high prices and unpaid salaries, halted traffic with burning tires and clashed with riot police in demonstrations across the West Bank last week, the largest show of popular discontent with the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank in its 18-year existence. The West Bank violence showed that the unrest, initially supported by Palestinian Fatah leaders in hopes of drawing international attention to the struggling economy there, risks backfiring and morphing into a broader movement against the Palestinian government. Youths yelled and cheered as they set tires alight, sending plumes of black smoke into the air, blocking the main road from the city of Ramallah to the nearby city of Jerusalem. Striking taxi and bus drivers scribbled the word taxi on a donkey in yellow paint. Very classy. The most heated clashes occurred in Hebron, where hundreds of protesters smashed the windows of a municipality building with rocks. The crowd tried to storm the building, but was thwarted by riot police, who fired tear gas and beat back the demonstrators. Protesters then tried to attack the police station, prompting a pitched rock-hurling battle between police and demonstrators. Apparently, they're both experienced at this. Oddly, there were no reported injuries. But the violence was significant because it targeted a symbol of Palestinian self-rule. Typically, the Palestinians have shown anger towards Israel, which has been in control of the West Bank since the 1967 war. Finally, in some actually positive Islamic news from the Middle East, this from Israel, members of a Muslim sect that translated parts of the Quran into Yiddish are marking 25 years since that translation was first published. The president of the Ahmadiyya Muslim community in Israel, Mohammed Sharif Odeh, said the group translated select parts of the Quran into Yiddish to present a different face of Islam. Odeh added, "We decided we had to make sure that our neighbors could also read the Quran." There are some 2,000 Ahmadiyya Muslims in Israel. Most of them live in Haifa's Kababir neighborhood. The sect says it has tens of millions of followers in more than 200 countries. The Ahmadiyya Muslim community translated parts of the Quran into Yiddish in 1987, one of 100 languages in which is translated parts of the Sacred Book of Islam. They want Yiddish speakers who want to know about us to be able to do so without language being an obstacle, Odeh explained. That decision to translate the Quran into Yiddish was made by the community's religious leader way back then, the fourth caliph, Mirza Tahir Ahmad, who was then living in Pakistan. The current caliph, the fifth one, Mirza Masroor Ahmad, resides in the UK. Odeh said that the particular selections that were translated show that Islam is not the way it is presented in Afghanistan, or we might add, the way it's presented in Egypt and Libya right now. He noted, for example, that before the Quran, women did not have rights. The Quran gives women full protection on the spiritual level and gives her an independent status. Most Israelis know little about the sect, the Ahmadiyyas, which is considered peaceful and non-proselytizing. Haifa Mayor Yonah Yahav has gone so far as to call them Reform Arabs. The community's motto is love for all, hatred for none. Good message. And for 25 years, they've made parts of the Quran available in Yiddish. And in Baltimore, Art Modell, the longtime owner of the Cleveland Browns and Baltimore Ravens, passed away last week, mourned everywhere in the NFL, except, of course, in Cleveland. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guests this morning, Helen Kim and Noah Levitt. They're the authors of The Newest Jews, Understanding Jewish American and Asian American Marriages, a study of some 37 couples who are Jewish Asian interracial couples. Well, I don't know, would you call it interracial, intercultural? What's the right term?
I think for all of the couples, there's an interracial component. So we were interested in talking with couples where one partner identifies racially as Asian American, but who comes from any ethnic or religious background, and the other partner identifies as Jewish American from any racial or ethnic background. So given sort of the confluence of all those different identities, we got a mishmash of interracial couples, interethnic couples, intercultural couples, folks who run the gamut. But for sure, they were interracial couples, all of them.
Have you explored what, because this is not exactly a new phenomenon to those of us who work in the Jewish world, have you explored what seems to attract Jews and Asians together?
People often make jokes about Asian values and Jewish values, and they sometimes are laughing, oh, well, do these line up or not? And what we learned from the couples who we had the chance to speak with is that they see themselves in their household as having alignments of all different kinds of values that they see as often helping create a firm foundation, a firm understanding of one another, and also, in many cases, a chance to work through and get around what may seem like a range of challenges to the relationship. As Helen mentioned, all these kinds of differences coming into the household, but yet because they see commonalities of value systems related to education and tradition, respect for their family, learning, hard work, all those kinds of things, when the households themselves and the members of the couple think about the relationship as having similarities along all those lines, it helps mitigate or perhaps make less challenging some of the things that are different about that.
You know, I've read a fair amount about Asian assimilation in the United States, and I'm wondering if seems like many of these couples are raising their kids Jewish with lots of signs of Jewish affiliation, connection, and continuity. Does that mean that they're somehow subsuming their Asian identity?
I think for most of the couples that is the case. And I think the way in which couples talked about the struggles in terms of instilling a sense of Asian identity, specifically ethnic identity, was having to do with an absence of institutional resources available to them to facilitate that. So, in many ways, instilling a Jewish identity, for lack of a better term, was easier because of the institutional community resources available to couples in their neighborhood. So, in the form of a synagogue, in the form of a day school, in the form of a JCC, also in the form of having a text to turn to, that is the clearest sort of material marker of what it means to be a Jew. When couples talked about trying to instill a sense of Asian identity, they often talked about an absence of those kinds of institutional resources and not being able to access them, predominantly because of issues having to do with convenience.
You have two kids of your own, Ari and Talia?
Yes.
So you probably interviewed them in... in a variety of ways that you wouldn't professionally interview people. Do they have any experience of it?
Well, Ari is 4 and Talia is 11 months.
Okay. So if they do, they're not interviewing at a very high level at this point.
No, they're not.
Although I'm sure they're brilliant children.
it is a good point in terms of parents often share stories with us about how they characterize their children racially, and they use a lot of different vocabulary and a lot of different ways of trying to physically describe what their kids look like, often a lot of real, I think, some challenges in terms of finding the right languages or descriptors to explain what it is that the kids of their couple would look like. And that seemed to really be on their minds for a lot of the parents we had to talk to. You know, what is it to talk about what your son or daughter looks like, and how might that have implications for their ability to fit in or convey a certain kind of identity or represent a tradition effectively? So it certainly was on their minds. And sometimes parents had kids who they talked about very differently, in part because of how they described their physical appearance. Sometimes looking much more one way than the other kid, or sometimes looking much more, seeing more Asian features, or having some kind of skin color, where the other child may not have had that, and what effects that might have on just the children's ability to grow and be part of the community.
The sort of funny you don't look Jewish phenomenon?
Yes, exactly. And I will say, on a personal level, in terms of Ari and Talia, one of the reasons that we named them Ari and Talia, we gave them Hebrew names in anticipation of challenges to their being Jewish, based on how it is that we expected they might look. That was a very explicit choice on our part in anticipation of this funny you don't look Jewish question.
You dedicated your article to the great demographer Gary Tobin, Zichrono Livracha, who's a former guest of Too Jewish. Tell us what he would have thought of your study.
Gary was really the one who pushed us to run with this. We had the chance to get to know him a few years before he passed, and it was at a point when we were just imagining what it would be like to actually conduct a significant academic research project on these kinds of households, and what would be involved, and not easy to get the data, how do you get to the households, how do you get to the couples. And Gary was very enthusiastic about taking on those research challenges to try to understand this, and certainly to try to understand what it meant for the coming generations of kids and their offspring who were being raised in households. variety of mixes of identity and background and tradition all coming together. So, I think he would have, been excited to see this actually turning into a real project and having had the chance to meet all these amazing families around the country, and now starting to think about the next generation of households like this, as Helen mentioned, the next phase of our project. But I think also Gary would have loved the creative and confident approaches that a lot of the households were taking in terms of carrying on Judaism in a way that was grounded in the experience of the households, but also then consistent with the larger courses of history and the what 4,000 years has meant for the Jewish people. So I think we'd be quite excited about it. We think about him a lot as we're kind of reviewing research notes and thinking about setting up interviews, making travel plans to meet the family, imagining that Gary is giving us his last day.
I think he would have said the study is good for the Jews.
That's always the question we ask.
Right. And he would have said, yes, it is good for the Jews, because the study demonstrates that when you put two people together and they fall in love and they're from, quote, different backgrounds, then the natural question that arises is the difference in their background, specifically the fact that one partner is Jewish and the other, is that going to be good for the Jews? And our study demonstrates that just because you have this difference doesn't necessarily mean an erosion of Judaism. In fact, the opposite is taking place. And he was very forward-thinking in terms of getting a community of people to think much more expansively about welcoming individuals, groups of people into the Jewish community. And I would say that he would probably say that there's something going on with these couples and in the larger communities that they're living in where this is happening. I think he would say it's good for me.
Yeah, I would say so too. And in I'm sure this is a racial stereotype, but I think that Asians were the only people that I knew in school who studied more and did better in school than the Jews did. So there's certainly another cultural piece there as well. I want to thank Helen Kim and Noah Levitt for a great visit here on Too Jewish, and we look forward to your continued work in this area and in others.
Great.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Shana Tova, a good year and a healthy year.
Shana Tova.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m., it'll be next year by then, when our guest will be Dr. Ian Stern, creator of Dig for a Day, talking about Israeli archaeology today. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or our TooJewishRadio.com website, and like us on Facebook. Our playout this morning comes from cantor David Fisher. It's our now traditional Shana Tova. May you have a good new year. Rosh Hashanah begins at sundown tonight. My friends, L'shana tova tika tevu v'techa temu. May you be written in the book of life for a good new year. And Shavua Tov. May this be a good first week of the Jewish year of 5773 and a week and a year, we pray, of peace.
Shana tova. Yamim holchim, yamim bayim, silchi gam at lachataim, rapi cholim, simchi noflim.
che se do verrà a me shana tova irvi halom veyadoshiti le shalom shana tova
shana tova
shana tova
Yamim
Yamim Yamim Yamim Yamim Yamim